in terms of cybersecurity protection for your organization, the most important is going to be security awareness training for the employees, just because that is the most frequently abused vector that attackers will take to compromise your organization.
Welcome to the latest episode of Unraveling IT Expert Tech Talks. Today, we're celebrating the start of Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and I have with me Ross Filipek, Chief Information Security Officer here at Corsica. I'm Brian Harmison, CEO of Corsica. Ross, welcome.
Good to have you. Thanks for having me, Brian.
Yeah, we talk about cybersecurity a lot here, and I feel like every month is Cybersecurity Awareness Month. What's kind of the origins of October being Cybersecurity Awareness Month?
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting. So Cybersecurity Awareness Month, you could kind of think of sort of a month-long public service announcement that's geared towards cybersecurity, obviously. And this actually came out of the Department of Homeland Security and the National Cybersecurity Alliance, I think back in 2004. But pretty early on, those groups recognized that cyber threats were starting to become more and more of a problem for individuals and for businesses in this country, and couple that with the fact that the people who were being targeted by these attacks were probably not very likely to have ever had any formal cyber awareness training in their lives. So the combination of those two factors together kind of made for a bad situation. So DHS and National Cybersecurity Alliance came up with this, you know, basically this marketing idea for every year, you know, having a month-long period of time where they would release, you know, hopefully like digestible and usable cybersecurity tips that the average person could understand and make use of to better protect themselves online. So, you know, in a nutshell, that was kind of the genesis, and it's sort of gone through some iterations over the years. But yeah, it's stuck around. It's been around for, you know, 20 years now.
Yeah, that's a long time. Mm-hmm. And cybersecurity has changed a lot in these 20 years. Do you feel like there are people who are still unaware of the threats?
Yeah, there are. And I think you're always going to have that. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, somebody has to want to learn, you know, they have to want to understand what they need to do to protect themselves against these cyber threats. So, you know, I think you're always going to have, you know, a certain percentage of the population who, you know, is going to try to defer to the IT department on everything and you know, kind of pass that problem off. But, you know, for the most part, over the years, I think we really have seen a dramatic improvement in the average person's, you know, kind of understanding of cyber threats and taking actions to protect themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, kind of the average person, because I do think most businesses that we talk to now know they need to be doing something. I see, you know, from a general population perspective, I definitely still talk to people who don't understand how it can impact their lives as well. And of course, good personal cyber hygiene translates to good corporate cyber hygiene. What are some of the things that you see from, you know, more of the personal side of cybersecurity that you feel like translate well to the corporate side of that? That, you know, as people think about cybersecurity awareness, how do we start with the individuals?
Yeah. So that's a great question. And there are definitely some fundamental, you know, cybersecurity best practices that are very applicable to personal life. You know, everybody, you know, most people nowadays have an Amazon account and a Netflix account and things like that. So
online bank accounts.
Bank accounts. Yeah. So starting out by making sure that you are using a different password for each of those accounts is really a very strong measure that you can take. You know, for the longest time, we kind of had to fight with people who, you know, maybe they came up with one, you know, really strong password, but then when you use that on every single account that you have, if any of those websites were to get breached, you know, guess what? Now the attacker's got your password. They can get into all your other accounts everywhere else. So being able to use a unique password for all your accounts, but then the problem becomes,
how do you remember them?
How do I remember? So this is where password managers come into play. So a password manager is basically a piece of software or an online service that you can use generally that integrates with your web browser on your computer. and it makes it very easy for you to come up with a different password for every account that you have on, you know, like I mentioned, Netflix and Amazon and all the sites like that. So it'll even come up with random passwords for you, so you don't even have to come up with them on your own, and it will remember them for you. So you don't even have to remember the passwords, even though they're very strong. And the password manager will automatically populate those passwords into that website when you're trying to log on. So it's highly secure. You know, it's a great way to manage having different passwords.
You know, I could see people saying, well, what about if the password manager gets compromised? Mm-hmm. How do you prevent that? What kinds of controls are typically in place?
Yeah. So generally to get into the password manager, you're having to do that from a device that you have physical access to. So for instance, when you install a password manager app on your phone, generally there's going to be like biometric, you know, face recognition, authentication, same concept with your laptop. In order for somebody to get into your password manager account directly, you know, online through a web browser, you know, there are secret keys and, you know, special codes that they have to enter in addition to
multi-factor.
Yeah. So that's the next thing I wanted to mention. So having unique passwords everywhere is very important, but we can even go one step further with the multi-factor authentication piece. And MFA has been around forever. You know, this is nothing new. And fortunately, just about every place that you would sign up for an account, you know, nowadays supports MFA. So there's really not a reason to not use it. But, you know, unfortunately, we still see a lot of these services make it optional. They don't force you to use it, and that can present a problem. But turning that on everywhere you can is a great idea.
Yeah, and multi-factor can look like a lot of different things, from text message to an authenticator app, to even built in to, you know, the operating system. So I think those are really good options. And yeah, usually I tell people, if it doesn't have MFA as an option, you have to ask yourself, do I really want to use this service? Is it, what am I putting in there that could be compromised? And I think as we look at younger generations who are willing to put all their info out online, it becomes really important that we protect the key pieces of that information.
Yeah.
We can, and as they enter the workforce, we need to have policies and procedures in place. You know, even with multi-factor, I feel like there can be some gaps. One of which is, you know, if you're getting a request to approve all the time, do you just click on approve and maybe not understand what generates those requests? Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
How that can be prevented? That's an interesting concept. So you're talking about something that we call MFA bombing. And here's what happens with that. Let's say that you've got a multi-factor app installed on your phone, you know, Google Authenticator, for instance,
or
Microsoft Authenticator, or something like that. And you've got multi-factor authentication turned on for logging into, you know, your Ticketmaster account, for instance.
Yep.
If you get phished, meaning that if an attacker sends you a phishing email and tricks you into giving away your username and password, now the attacker is going to sit there and try to log in as you. But because you've got multi-factor authentication required, every time that attacker tries to log in, all of a sudden you are getting an MFA pop-up on your phone. So the first red flag to pay attention to is if you start getting MFA pop-ups on that app that you have on your phone, but it wasn't
you trying to log in.
So that's a dead giveaway that somebody is trying to log in as you. So change your password immediately. But even on the multi-factor authentication piece, a lot of systems now support something called number matching that, you know, in addition to the MFA push, requires you to enter like a short random code in order to log in. So that's how we protect against things like MFA bombing.
Yeah, and we see that certainly on M365 side. We've implemented that as well. So you mentioned phishing. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about phishing a little bit more. It's still the number one way.
Yeah. 80%.
And it's getting better. It's getting better all the time. AI, you know, we talk about AI a lot. This is an area that AI is not helping us. Protect the good guys in this case.
Yeah, that's true. So 80% of all successful cyber attacks actually start with social engineering, you know, primarily phishing. And it makes sense if you know, think about it from the attacker's standpoint. They like to work smart, not hard, you know, just like the rest of us. So if I'm an attacker, what do I want to spend a week or a month or even a year trying to hack my way in to your environment. Well, I could just fish all your users and
right. trick them into somebody give it away.
Yeah, exactly. It makes it so much easier for the attackers. So yeah, having some awareness of social engineering attacks amongst your employee base is really important. So that really underscores the importance of a solid cybersecurity awareness training program for your employees. In fact, I would say of anything that you could possibly spend money on in terms of cybersecurity protection for your organization, the most important is going to be security awareness training for the employees, just because that is the most frequently abused vector that attackers will take to compromise your organization.
Yeah, I agree with that. I see it all the time. I think as a business decision maker, you know, frequently targeted for all kinds of different attacks, you know, whether it be, you know, wire fraud or just giving away some set of credentials or bank account, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. See it a lot. But those things do become more difficult when we have MFA in place, because then if somebody does fail, we have some other level of protection.
Yep.
What are some of the things that can happen behind the scenes that can also detect when someone has been phished and, you know, provide an opportunity to take action against that?
Yeah, so paying attention to logs that are coming from the system. So one of the things that I think we do a good job here of at Corsica is ingesting and analyzing logs from Microsoft 365, for instance. So let's say that we've got an employee who gets phished and the attacker is located in China or someplace like that, and we start to see logon attempts with our employees account coming from China, Russia, you know, someplace geographically separate from where we would normally expect those logon right. attempts to come from. That's going to trigger an alert that goes to our security operations center for investigation. So there's some really great things we can do with log analytics and kind of behavioral baselining for those logon.
And that points back to that user, gives us a chance to go and educate them. Mm-hmm. Review, what did you click on? How did that happen? Because I think one of the important aspects of, you know, that user awareness training is also reporting when you have been phished.
Oh, so yeah, for sure.
There's probably a message and a timing that could trick about any of us. When that happens, what should those people do when they realize they've been phished? They entered their corporate credentials somewhere that is not legitimate.
Yeah, definitely. The first thing you should do is report that to your IT department. You know, let them know what happened and what you suspected, and they will investigate. They'll likely engage Corsica, if we're working with that organization to help them investigate. And generally, there's a lot that we're able to learn from investigating the email itself, you know, looking at the headers, looking to see where it came from, different red flags that we pay attention to. So in addition to investigating the email itself, it's always a good practice to change your password, right. Whatever password you happen to enter as a result of clicking that phishing link. We want to change that right away. We want to make sure if that logon was for an account that supports multi-factor authentication, let's make sure we have that turned on and it's functional. So yeah, some good follow-up actions for that.
Yeah, that's great. What else do you see happening in kind of the cybersecurity landscape? I touched on AI a little bit. We're certainly seeing, you know, increased frequency of AI-based attacks. What else are you seeing now? You know, that's kind of the new frontier of cybersecurity.
Yeah, it really just on that AI front, you know, 5 years ago, I think it was pretty easy to spot a lot of phishing attacks because half the words were spelled wrong.
Right.
You know,
incomplete
grammar,
English,
you know,
right.
Things like that. So, you know, nowadays with cyber criminals having ubiquitous access to AI, you know, generative AI tools, even a non-native English speaker or a cyber criminal who can't even speak a word of English can compose a perfectly written, very compelling email message that, you know, just makes it very difficult. Really what's happened is we've lost a lot of the red flags that previously we could rely on to determine whether something was really a phishing attack or not. So that just really underscores the importance of, you know, things like multi-factor authentication. And, you know, it's not, you know, exciting, but making sure you're keeping your systems patched and up to date, you know, because we still see a lot of these attacks coupled with exploitation of vulnerabilities. So minimizing attackers' ability to do that, I think, is important as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And those are things that we see. You know, you mentioned vulnerabilities. You know, a lot of IT teams, it's kind of the last thing on their list because they're keeping, you know, kind of the core business functions running, which is an area that we help out in a lot, patch a lot of systems and keep those up to date. You know, you mentioned something that made me think of who can we trust when it comes to, you know, our identity online, and that gets into zero trust and those concepts. Do you mind just touching briefly on that? Because I think it's a good way to live when it comes to our, you know, digital identity. Maybe share a little bit about that.
Yeah, for sure. So this concept of zero trust, I think it's easier to understand that if we talk about how things were, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Back then, a lot of organizations were set up so that as long as you were coming into the office to work, you had the ability to access certain things in a different way than you would have to access them if you were coming from home.
So kind of like you're, you know, when you're in your house, you feel safe. And therefore, you know, you might not lock your car up in the garage because it's in the house.
Yep. So now the concept of zero trust really turns that idea of, you know, some trusted geographical space on its head. So with zero trust, we are assuming that all devices have been compromised in some way, shape, or form. So what we want to do now with any device access to our resources, whether the device is coming from the office, whether it's coming from home, we want to be very granular about authenticating the user and then authorizing that session so that we're allowing it to do only what it needs to be able to do, but nothing above and beyond that. So Microsoft's really got some great capabilities for zero trust, but at the end of the day, zero trust is really all about right sizing the access so that devices and users are able to get to exactly what they should be able to get to, but nothing else.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. So we're saying we're not by default trusting.
Correct.
Yep. We're going to make you authenticate, and we're going to do that at the right level for what you're trying to do. You know, one of the things I hear is, you know, a lot of these things sound kind of inconvenient. I know, you know, we have a lot of this in place for Corsica, and, you know, I do a fair amount of multi-factor, but I look at that as, you know, no different than turning the deadbolt on my house or locking my car as I walk away. And I think culturally, we have to help businesses adopt this idea that the couple extra steps are worth it. And they are getting more and more convenient and more intelligent. What's your advice, you know, as you talk to maybe a less technical business decision maker about how to think about their cybersecurity posture as a business?
Yeah, so definitely we want to get back to that concept of security awareness training for employees and being able to recognize especially the social engineering aspect of cyber threats, because it's, you know, obviously a huge problem today, and it's only going to become a larger and larger problem as time goes on. Yeah, you know, so that's definitely an important piece. And then also talking to them about, you know, things like zero trust concepts, where instead of implicitly trusting all of our employees and their devices, we're making sure they earn that trust. But, you know, I can tell you that zero trust implementation, if it's done correctly, the impact to user experience really isn't anything that, you know, is a detriment. In fact, you know, under our zero trust model, you know, I think my user experience with logging onto systems is actually better than what it was before that.
I agree. And especially for those of us that have things like Windows Hello integrated into that has biometric capability. Also, I know on my machine, I have Hello integrated with my password manager. So even on my laptop, it's authenticating me biometrically before filling in those passwords. So a lot of tools available. Ultimately, though, the company culture has to be ready to embrace those things, be on board with it. And, you know, when I think of awareness, that's part of my message to the executives, which is, We have to look at IT and the things that they're bringing forward as an ally, as a part of our business continuity planning process. And that hasn't always been the way IT's thought of. A lot of times, you know, these are IT's trying to control what we're doing. It's inconvenient. That's not our view of the world, which is IT's got to have a seat at the table to ensure that business continuity, ensure that the business can sustain ongoing operations.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, Ross, thanks so much for the time today. always fun to talk about cybersecurity. It's something that is top of mind. I don't know that we need Cybersecurity Awareness Month anymore, but it's still good to sit down and really think through where we're at today. So thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. Thanks.